Okay. One of the main driving forces in the last 25 years or so in particle physics has been the question of why gravity is so weak. And from 1974, we've had the standard desert paradigm, according to which gravity is weak because it lives at some very distant energy scale. In the last year and a half, there has been a new framework developing in which to attempt to understand this question, in which gravity is weak because graviton lives far away from all the other elementary particles that we know. So this large bulk framework, the fundamental aspects of the large bulk framework are familiar to the audience here, so I'll just summarize them, are that there is a fundamental scale of the order of a TeV. Gravity is weak because graviton lives far away. All other particles live on a three-dimensional space, electrons, photons, quarks, etc. And the space inside the extra dimensions is generically referred to as the bulk. It's n-dimensional in general, and its size is R. Quantitatively, a bit more quantitatively, to understand the weakness of the gravitational coupling, we can argue as follows. Here is a picture of the bulk. Our three-dimensional space is just a point in that bulk. So graviton lives everywhere, so its wave function is smeared everywhere. The amplitude that the graviton will find us is inversely proportional to the root of the volume. Root volume is the Planck mass, therefore. And from that, you derive the well-known relation relating the volume of the extra dimensions and the Planck mass. And the result is that for n equal 1, for one extra dimension, the size of the extra dimension would have to be too large. For two extra dimensions, turns out to be about a millimeter. For six, it's about 10 Fermi. So I take that this is all familiar. So the main theme that I'm going to pursue here is the following. There is a large, according to the old framework, the so-called desert framework, all of physics, at least beyond the standard model, happens in a big energy desert extending from the weak to the Planck mass. And in particular, there is a large list of phenomena or mechanisms that are embedded in that energy desert. Most notably, there is a unification of couplings and the neutrino masses, which are perhaps the most concrete indications of the existence of an energy desert. What we are going to do is we are going to discuss analogon mechanisms in the new framework. In the new framework, we need a new arena to do physics. This will, of course, very naturally turn out to be the bulk or the space, the extra space that is provided for us. So the arena now will be position space instead of energy space. And what we want to do is point out mechanisms and phenomena that can happen in the bulk to replace the mechanisms and phenomena that I have listed on the left here, unification, neutrino masses, proton stability, dark matter, and inflation. Unification I'm not going to talk about because Nima Arkani Hamed will talk in the talk immediately afterwards. So the outline of my talk will be as follows. I'll begin with a brief overview of why this framework is safe and some of the basic experimental consequences. This will be discussed in more detail by Jim Wells and Michael Peskin. And then I'll talk about three topics, particle physics in the bulk, astrophysics in the bulk, and cosmology in the bulk, if I have time. On the issue of particle physics, I'll discuss the same issues I mentioned in the previous transparency in particular neutrino masses, proton stability, and perhaps flavor. On astrophysics, I'll discuss what are a particularly interesting dark matter candidate in these theories. And if I have time, I'll mention how you can implement inflationary scenario in this framework. And again, some of these topics will be covered. The last two topics will also be covered in Gear Valley's talk. So let me begin with why the framework is safe. And I'll just effectively summarize by showing you a long list of possible worries in such a drastic change of our basic picture of the world. And the worries come in two categories. First category is associated with the fact that you have new physics at the TV, more specifically you have strong gravity at the TV. And this can induce processes, a variety of processes that I have listed here, that roughly fall in two categories. Those that can be suppressed essentially adequately once the scale is about a TV, because the scale of a TV is significantly higher than the scale that we do precision experiments. And then there is a second class of processes which can be forbidden by symmetries. Okay? And we'll discuss some aspects of some mechanisms that can suppress such processes. I should say this class of problems occur not just if in our framework, but in any framework that introduces new physics at a TV, whether it's supersymmetry or technicolor or large extra dimensions. So these issues are common with other frameworks, and the solutions that we'll present perhaps have parallels. A second class of totally new problems, not shared by other proposals for new physics at a TV, is that because it's gravity that we are changing at a TV, we have new gravitational degrees of freedom. In particular, we have 10 to the 32 four-dimensional graviton-like particles. And these lead to a plethora of possible concerns coming from laboratory, astrophysical, and cosmological processes. Okay, to put it in the most pessimistic light, we know, for example, if you introduce a particle called the axion at the TV, this theory immediately is excluded. So how can we possibly get away with introducing gravitons at that energy scale? And so this is a list of everything, some of the things that we're worried about. So let me just discuss just a few of these concerns. Perhaps the zeroth order concern that you might have is that changing gravity at a submillimeter scale would change the dynamics of a star, the energetics of a star. Okay, because the gravitational self-energy now inside a sphere of a millimeter, each and every sphere of the order of a millimeter, would change. And isn't that a concern? Doesn't that change gravitational binding energy? This turns out not to be the case for a very simple reason. The gravitational self-energy of a star is an infrared effect, comes from particles that are separated as far apart from each other as possible. So changing physics at a millimeter, although within each millimeter sphere you have a macroscopic number of elementary particles, because the gravitational self-energy comes from far away points, this is a minor perturbation, and it doesn't change the energetics of the star appreciably. Second, which will turn out to be one of the strongest bounds, is the supernova. Okay? Supernova 1987A in particular, on which we have data, now can cool by emitting gravitons inside the extra dimension. So here is the supernova. It can undergo a process that is nucleon-nucleon collisions with the simultaneous emission of a graviton inside the ball. Or you can have a Gravi-Primakov process where a photon converts to a graviton in the field of a high-Z nucleus. And both of these can cool the supernova by bulk evaporation and significantly alter its dynamics. Okay. Result that I will present in a short while is that if the fundamental scale is a TV, and if you have more than two extra dimensions, this turns out to be totally safe. If you have just two extra dimensions, the scale has to be pushed up to 30 TV. The fundamental scale can no longer be 1 TV. It has to be pushed up to 30 TV. Then there is a number of cosmological constraints that are highly a priori dangerous. For example, you don't want to change the kinematics of the universe during Big Bang nucleosynthesis. Normally, the Big Bang universe cools by adiabatic expansion. This is called Hubble's law. It cools by adiabatically expanding, stretching the wavelengths of all the particles in the system. Now there is a new process called cooling by evaporation, where collisions on our wall lead to gravitons evaporated in the bulk. So it's important that normal cooling by Hubble cooling by adiabatic expansion dominates over evaporative cooling, and this puts some constraints. This star is the maximum temperature below which the universe can behave normally. In other words, in particular, it can be dominated by adiabatic expansion. Its cooling can be dominated by adiabatic expansion. And the important point on this transparency is that this star is bigger than 1 MeV, where nucleosynthesis commences, so you don't alter primordial nucleosynthesis, which is really the only detailed quantitative success of early cosmology. Even more, there are important effects when you cool by throwing by producing gravitons into the bulk. There is a bunch of possible dangers, such as overclosing the universe. The gravitons that are inside the bulk behave like non-relativistic particles, that namely just like ordinary matter that eventually may dominate and overclose the universe. They can also affect Big Bang nucleosynthesis by making the universe expand more rapidly, and therefore increase the abundance of helium-4, because neutrons have no time to convert to protons. They can distort the gamma-ray background spectrum. These gravitons, although they are emitted inside the bulk, they have some probability of coming back and interacting with us and decaying in the process to pairs of photons, and that would distort the gamma-ray background. So these are the strongest constraints. Let me just list what they imply without going into further details. Here it is. If you have more than two extra dimensions, the fundamental scale can be as low as a TV, and all of these constraints are satisfied. For more than two extra dimensions, you have stringent constraints from the things that I showed you, the supernova, overclosing the universe, and gamma ray distortions. So these are our own estimates of these constraints, and these are later improvements from more detailed calculations by Cullen and Perelstein and Hall and Smith. Okay? And you see that, roughly speaking, if you take all of these things at face value, about 100 TV is the scale that you have to push, the scale of the new physics, if you have two extra dimensions. Again, this is not completely solid. Remember that this comes from gamma ray distortion, which is, in fact, this constraint can be invaded in a very simple way by postulating that there is a fat brain in the bulk. So if a graviton ventures inside the bulk, then there is a large probability that it will decay into this fat brain, and then the non-relativistic decay products can be, in fact, natural dark matter. So this is one way you can evade. These bounds are not dead solid, but if you take the absolutely simplest scenario, for exactly two extra dimensions, the scale has to be 100 TV. That's right. That's what I mean by the fat brain. That's right. Something thick. Doesn't occupy the whole space. Okay. Let me summarize now what I just said. So this basically ensures that the graviton that you emit doesn't return to your brain to decay into photons. That's all it does. Why is the framework alive can be summarized in a very simple way. It's really a consequence of just Gauss's law. According to Gauss's law, here is Gauss's law, the gravitational field of a point particle drops like 1 over r to the 2 plus n. If you take the Fourier transform of the gravitational field, you get the rate for the emission of a graviton inside the bulk, and you find that the Fourier transform of Gauss's law gives you that the rate, that rate is inversely proportional to this large power of the Planck mass times the available energy to this power, large power, 2 plus n, where n is the number of extra dimensions. So notice two things, and most important, notice that as you increase the number of extra dimensions, the theory gets safer and safer. For any available energy, any physical process that you've measured very precisely with available energy P, as you increase the number of extra dimensions, the rate for emitting gravitons from that process decreases. And the reason, again, is the infrared nature, is Gauss's law, that if you go a given distance away from a point charge, its gravitational field decreases as you crank up the number of dimensions. So that's what saves the day, and that's what, in fact, makes more dimensions safer instead of less safe. Experimental consequences, I will not summarize. I will not go beyond the summary because Jim Wells and Michael Peskin will talk about it. I just want to say that there are two classes of experimental predictions in these theories: tabletop experiments and accelerator experiments. Accelerator experiments involve missing energy. You can have a elementary particle collision, which leads to gravitons being evaporated in the bulk. Virtual particle exchanges. Of course, if the scale is a TV, lots of new states at a TV, Kaluza-Klein, winding, string vibrations, etc. And on tabletop experiments, I want to mention that there are two sources of new experimental signatures in tabletop experiments. First, if you have two extra dimensions, you may see a transition from Newton's law, 1 over r squared, to, for example, 1 over r to the fourth. Or if one of the dimensions is much larger than the other, you can have transition from 1 over r squared to 1 over r cubed, and then to 1 over r to the fourth. So that's one possibility. Second, quite generic possibility, is that you find new, in this class of theories that I'll come to in a little while, is that you can have particles with millimeter-sized Compton wavelengths. And such particles occur, as you will see, independent of the number of extra dimensions. The reason why these particles have millimeter wavelength has nothing to do with having two dimensions or six extra dimensions. It has to do with the statement that a gravitationally coupled particle that gets its mass from weak interactions has a mass of the order of sub-milli electron volts, which has a Compton wavelength of a millimeter. And I'll come to that in some detail. Of course, there is a great deal of excitement. There is actually at least two experiments that I know of that will probe sub-millimeter as gravity. Here is our knowledge of gravitational force as a function of distance. This is a centimeter. This is a micron. Red line, above the red line, everything is excluded. So you see that gravity has been measured, gravitational force has been measured up to a millimeter. New experiments will significantly improve or discover new phenomena. For example, even a distance as large as 100 microns, at the moment, we could have a force 10 to the 7 times gravity, and we wouldn't know about it. Wells and Peskin will talk more about this. You can ask how far deep into the new physics range will various accelerators probe. And here are various machines and how far they can probe new physics. For example, the next linear collider for two extra dimensions can probe a fundamental gravitational scale up to 7 TeV. The LHC can go up to 4 TeV, and if there are six extra dimensions, up to about 3 TeV. So this gives you an idea of the range that can be probed by upcoming accelerator experiments. Now I finished my summary. I want to discuss a bit about particle. How do you do particle physics in the bulk? As I said, unification will be discussed by Nima Arkani Hamed. So I'll talk instead about other phenomena, in particular about a plethora of phenomena that are normally accounted for by the desert. Okay? So here is the desert. A large number of mechanisms are embedded here. For example, small numbers like the neutrino mass or the baryon number violating processes are understood as being small because they involve big energy denominators. Okay. So what do we do now that we have lost the desert? And the basic idea is the following. The idea is that there is a plethora of particles and other universes or other three-dimensional spaces that can live inside the bulk. And in such a situation, we can have a plethora of phenomena that can be understood either as a result of remnant physics that we observe on our world that originates in other three brains, or small couplings of a particle that lives in the bulk as it couples to us because its wave function is spread throughout the bulk. So to give you an example of the latter, let me postulate that there is a singlet, an SU3 cross U, SU2 cross U1 singlet particle, fermion, called the neutrino that lives in the bulk. How can we understand the smallness of the neutrino mass in this framework? Okay, the wave function of this singlet particle, which I call nu right, is smeared throughout the bulk. Of course, our left-hand neutrino is localized on our brain, and the overlap between the wave function of the two is, of course, is very small. It goes like 1 over the square root of the volume. Now, remember, the square root of the volume is equal to the Planck mass in this framework. So the neutrino mass that you deduce from this situation is that it's inversely proportional to the Planck mass and, of course, proportional to the electroweak scale, to the vacuum expectation value of weak interactions times the fundamental scale of quantum gravity. So if you take this fundamental scale to be of the order of a TeV, you reproduce the seesaw prediction for the neutrino mass of the order of 10 to the minus 3 eV, which is, of course, perfect for explaining the solar neutrino problem. So in this picture, the neutrino is light for the same reason that gravity is weak, namely the right-handed partner of the neutrino is smeared over a big space and it rarely encounters the left-handed partner. In fact, you can see a variation on this theme. Okay, so here is a variation on this theme that may be of use if you want to reproduce the atmospheric neutrino mass. Imagine that you have a right-handed neutrino that does not live in the totality of the bulk, but it lives on a subspace that intersects us. Okay. Then again, its wave function is smeared, but it's not as smeared as someone that lives throughout the bulk, so its mass turns out to be a little higher. If m is the dimensionality of the space in which this new right lives, and n is the dimensionality of the full bulk, you easily reproduce this relation. And here is just an example for m equals 5 and n equals 6. You can reproduce a different mass range for the neutrino. So there is many possibilities. Let me focus on one that is particularly interesting for submillimeter experiments. Imagine now that you have a vector particle that lives in the bulk. Okay? This could be, for example, a gauge particle of U1 baryon number. You just gauge U1 baryon number in the bulk. Okay? Or any other U1 that you choose to gauge in the bulk. Again, now, the photon associated with the Gauge boson associated with this particle is smeared throughout the bulk. Its coupling constant, therefore, to us is suppressed by this 1 over the square root of the volume, which is the same as the inverse Planck mass, which, because we are using TeV units, is 10 to the minus 16. Now, that's an infinitesimal gauge coupling, extremely small. However, it is a million, it leads to a force that is a million times bigger than the gravitational force between two protons. Okay? And the reason why it's a million times bigger is because the TeV scale, which enters in this coupling constant, is 1,000 times bigger than the proton mass, and that translates into a million times stronger force. So if such a particle was massless, of course, the theory would be excluded instantly, and the Earth and the Sun would repel with a force a million times bigger than gravity. So we need to give a mass to this, to such a particle. And the simplest way to do it is to just say that the symmetry, the gauge symmetry corresponding to this particle, is broken on another wall, on another three brain. Now you can compute the mass of this gauge boson. Say that again. I'm saying spontaneously broken. I'm saying that it's spontaneously broken on that wall. That's right.
You can.
That's right. Let's talk about this afterwards. You can imagine, for the moment, imagine that you cancel the anomaly by adding extra particles that carry baryon number, okay? Then you don't have a problem with gauging it. Furthermore, these extra particles you can push all the way up to a TeV. And then they are not part of the low energy effective theory. And please ask this question at the end. I'll show you why TeV is okay. Because there is an upper limit to the cutoff of the theory, which is the mass divided by the U1 anomaly, which says that you can have the particles that cancel its anomaly all the way up to a TeV. Okay. So the Compton wavelength of these particles is in the millimeter range. Notice that this has nothing to do with the existence of two extra dimensions. This is valid because, if you wish, the square of the weak interaction scale divided by the Planck mass is of the order of an inverse millimeter. This is the accident that we are observing over and over again. So, now, okay, I don't have time to go further. You can extend these ideas to try to construct theories of flavor, and several people have done so recently. In that version of the, in this idea, the Yukawa couplings are interpreted as bulk fields, and the values of the Yukawa couplings on our wall can be small because they originate in some other wall where there are sources for these Yukawa fields, which of course have an exponential profile. And in this way, you can try to understand masses, and you can see. And it turns out that in a broad class of such theories, you can avoid problems with flavor-changing processes. Okay, I just want to summarize the mechanisms that were discussed in this section. So bulk fields have volume-suppressed couplings, okay? Graviton is one example, and we discussed two more examples. Neutrino masses can be small because the right-handed partner lives in the bulk, and vector particles can be light because they live in the bulk. And symmetries can be broken, that are broken badly far away, can be weakly broken when this breaking is transmitted to our wall via messenger fields. And I didn't discuss this in detail, but you can use this to violate baryon number far away or flavor, etc. Now I want to come to some. So far, I've spoken about particle physics and consequences of this picture. Next, I want to move to some astrophysical consequences. And a priori, you might think, well, it's very unlikely to find new astrophysical consequences. Once we made sure that we were safe for supernova and for the sun and for all the other, from all the other astrophysical constraints that I discussed in the beginning, you reproduce just the standard astrophysics that we're familiar with in the standard model. this is not quite the case, and that, so I want to discuss some new ideas on how actually this framework could affect standard astrophysics. Okay? Consider that you have a folded brain. In other words, consider that here is the extra dimension, a millimeter large, say, and consider that you have a brain that is first of all folded, whose and his vertical size, I've denoted it here, can be of astronomical size. This distance L can be trillions times bigger than the size of our present universe, or it can be of the order of the size of our present universe. I'll actually derive limits on the size of these things by simple consideration. So this is definitely not drawn to scale. This is a millimeter, and this is millions or thousands of megaparsecs, okay? So we live here on the left, and there is another world that is identical, that has identical microphysics and identical astrophysics to our world. And now there is two classes of predictions, two classes of manifestations of this framework, that if L is bigger than the Hubble, you have one type of experimental consequences. If L is less than Hubble, than the radius of the universe, then you have even more experimental consequences. Quite independent of that, let me make some general comments. First of all, notice that in this framework, the gravitational distance between two particles, say us, this is our galaxy, and this is some other object on the other side, the gravitational distance is much shorter than the electromagnetic distance. In particular, you can have stuff right next to us, okay? Because it will be right next to us, of course, we will feel its gravity. This will be like dark matter as far as we are concerned. But in principle, it won't be dark forever. In principle, if light could go around and come back, eventually we could see it. And you might even have a situation where you see some violent events in the sky, and you say, oh boy, that's far away. It can't possibly affect me, but in fact, it may be right next door to you. Okay? And it may be emitting, or it may have emitted gravitational waves, violent gravitational waves in the past. Okay, now, what happens to matter on this side? Matter on the right-hand side acts, of course, is just, it looks like dark matter, in spite of the fact that it is baryonic. It's made out of the same stuff, quarks and leptons, that we are made out of. Okay? It's baryonic, yet invisible. In particular, it has the same astrophysics. It has the same Chandrasekhar mass. It has the same stellar objects. Therefore, you... Yes, I'll actually talk about right-handed neutrinos. This is in 1 second. That's right. Right-handed neutrinos that go in the bulk, find a left-handed neutrino here, which acts like a sterile neutrino with 45-degree mixing angle, because the mixing of neutrinos is the same here and here, since the physics is identical. So this is the simplest way to get a 45-degree mixing angle for a neutrino. Okay. So you have normal stars, and so one prediction of such a framework could be that normal stars, the machos, the objects that cause gravitational lensing, are actually normal stars, and therefore they should have a mass in some normal star range, perhaps of the order of a solar mass. Okay. Furthermore, this matter here is dissipating. Okay, since the matter is dissipating, it is collapsing. It's dissipating identically to the way our own matter is dissipating. So it is collapsing, and in the process of collapse, it gives rise to further gravitational waves over and above what the gravitational waves that we would expect by looking at the matter on our side. So you would expect an enhancement of the gravity wave signal coming from the other side. Furthermore, there is the possibility that things that look far away are actually closer, so that would further enhance the gravity wave signals. Now, how can you make... Oh, you mean how... imagine for the moment that this is way outside, this has been hyperinflated superluminally. So this is, you know, e to the trillion times the Hubble radius. So this is very far away. So even if it's moving at the speed of light towards us, we are not likely to see it in our lifetimes. Okay? Okay. So, yes, please. Close together. I mean, this is a millimeter. I don't know what's your definition of close together. Yeah, I mean, you're talking about a millimeter. There can be fluctuations. Yeah, I mean, the amount of space these guys have to wiggle is a millimeter. So you can imagine, I don't know what you mean large. This can only bend up to a millimeter. Okay? Constraints on this picture. First constraint comes from nucleosynthesis, okay? And this is easy to understand as follows. Imagine that during nucleosynthesis, we know that you cannot have any more species than one extra neutrino. So this means that during nucleosynthesis, there better not be any extra radiation here, or else, if there was, it would change the expansion rate of the universe and increase the abundance of helium-4. Okay, so that forces the temperature of this wall on the right to be less than the temperature of the wall on the left during nucleosynthesis. But this means that the deuterium abundance on this side, on the right, is different than the deuterium abundance that we observe on the left. But deuterium abundance has been measured up to cosmological distances. There is this hydrogen absorption clouds that are absorbing light from a quasar, and by looking at at the quasar absorption lines, you deduce an amount of deuterium abundance very far away, cosmological distances, comparable of the same order as the deuterium abundance that we observe in our neighborhood. Of course, so if you take this at face value, this is just one number and it's an approximate coincidence. But if you take this at face value, it strongly suggests that this L, that the deuterium that we are observing is not on the other side, and that this L, the distance from us to the closest tip of a fold, is bigger than Hubble. Okay? So that's the simplest reconciliation. Furthermore, there is much more significant constraints to this idea from the requirement that halos, galactic halos, are much bigger than the galaxies. Okay? Now, if matter here forms dark matter, because it's made out of the same stuff, it has the same dissipational properties. So a priori, it's hard to understand if it has the same dissipational properties, how come it didn't clump to very small sizes of the order of galaxies, or even smaller, because matter here is much denser. If it is dark matter, matter here has to be 30 times denser than the matter, normal matter on the left. So it would dissipate even more and form, presumably, even smaller objects, not even having a chance to explain the galactic halo sizes. So that looks very bad. In fact, something looks even worse. You might form, if you have this matter very well mixed with, yes? Okay, I'm converging. Okay, hard to tell. But if you have matter that is very well mixed, our matter after recombination is very well mixed with this matter, just a soup, except there is 30 times as much of that soup than of our soup, okay? This raises the strong possibility, since they have identical dissipational properties, that you would form hybrid objects, hybrid globular clusters, or hybrid first-generation stars. And clearly excluded, we know that globular clusters are the biggest objects in the sky that don't need any dark matter at all. So you have to avoid such missing. So it's quite clear that the number density on the right, of baryons on the right, has to be much less than the number density on the left. Therefore, if you are going to have dark matter, by having it leap on other folds, you actually need many folds. Okay? Okay? So here is the simplest picture. You have many folds, and you can ask how many, where it's not hard to... Can you ask afterwards, because I've been given an ultimatum? Please. Okay. Okay. How many of these folds do you need? Of course, we don't know exactly. That's a difficult calculation. However, we know that the critical density, we are missing roughly a factor of 30 in the mass of the universe. So if the number density, imagine that all of these folds on the right have the same physics, okay, have roughly the same baryon abundance. Okay, so the average baryon abundance on these guys must be 30 divided by the number of folds times the baryon abundance on us. Then the cooling time, the time that it takes for these things to cool and form structures, okay, scales is inversely proportional to the number density of baryons, because that's what dictates the collisional frequency that gives rise to dissipation and cooling and clumping into galactic size objects. So to make a short story shorter, if you have about 100 to 200 folds, then you figure out that the cooling, that these guys are cooling now or yesterday. So this means that they are just clumping. They have stopped. They have just started forming stars and just now. So this means that they are good candidates for big halos. And furthermore, there is a chance that you have collapses occurring there, giving rise to gravitational waves, and mature stars have formed. Of course, this is a complicated scenario, just like even the cold dark matter scenario that had totally dissipationless matter was complicated to run. This is even more complicated because you have dissipation. So there is a program. If you give me two numbers, the ratio of the temperatures on the other folds to our fold, and the number of folds, then, in principle, I could definitely do Big Bang nucleosynthesis on other folds. There is codes that can easily do that. And what is harder to do is to study structure formation, especially at shorter and shorter length scales on the other folds. But there are some easy expectations, as I emphasized before. First, on the other folds, you'll form more helium-4. Okay, that's obvious because the other folds are expanding mostly because of our number density, our photon density, and our photons are hotter. So as far as they are concerned, they have hundreds of neutrinos that are contributing to their expansion rate. So neutrons don't have time to go into protons, and they form more helium-4. Helium-4 is an inert molecule, so this decreases significantly the dissipation and null properties due to molecular collisions, and this gives rise to longer cooling time. Okay? So that's one expectation. Now, as the number of folds goes to infinity, of course, you will produce exactly cold dark matter predictions because you lose completely dissipation. The other side is too thin to dissipate. There is no collisions. So an interesting problem, difficult probably, is to find the range of the number of folds and the ratio of temperatures to those there and here, and to see for what ranges you can have big galactic halos, just like we observe, nevertheless collapsing stars and matches. So at this point, I have another 5 minutes, right? Oh, okay, just 1 second. Okay, I'll skip the next. This is just a quick response to Misha's comment. Indeed, you can get 45 degrees mixing angles if you have bifolds, and because the right-handed neutrino mixes with the crucial point is if this side and this side has identical physics, this mixing, this coupling and that coupling are the same, so you get 45 degrees. Finally, this is just a comment in passing. Traditional mirror models, you can see, have difficulties with these considerations because, as I've shown, you will need 100. You can't just have our theory cross a mirror. One mirror would be bad because of what I explained to you. One mirror is like a bifold. So you need 100 copies, but even with 100 copies, the mirror photons mix with ours and give rise to laboratory disasters. Nucleosynthesis would be bad because if you have such a mixing, our photons would heat up the other photons, so you would have 100 times the species that we need to do nucleosynthesis. And, of course, this is avoided in theories with many folds because of locality. Each fold is a millimeter, or roughly, you know, 1% of a millimeter away from the next fold. So there is no such operator that causes one photon to hit the other photon. Okay, I don't have time to discuss cosmology. I'll just summarize consequences. New framework for particle physics, which may provide us with a fresh way to look on old problems. New tabletop and accelerator signatures. We discussed many mechanisms and phenomena that can be used in particle physics as well as astrophysics. Didn't have time to discuss cosmology. There is even more phenomena that you'll hear about once you assume that the extra dimensions is not a flat space, but it's curved. And you'll hear from Raman and Joe and Herman and Mark talks on this subject. Of course, all of these finding new mechanisms and new phenomena is just wonderful. At the end of the day, we should ask ourselves, is this really as good as the supersymmetric standard model or Susie Gutz? Of course, the answer is no, at least not yet, for a simple reason. We don't have a concrete model in which the framework, in the frame of which to discuss physics. As Nima will tell you, there are ideas even for unification, but until you embed them in a top-down explicit model, these ideas will not be as good competitors to the minimal supersymmetric grand unified theories. Thank you. Yeah. You mean why they don't? Yeah. I'll tell you, there are simple field theoretic models. I don't know if you'll talk now about it. Field theoretic, simple 5-4 theories. You can have a free bulk field that has. You'll talk about it in your talk. Yeah. You can easily. Yeah. Right. Anyway, next question. So. It's almost a definition. We have to be the hottest because of nucleosynthesis. And we have to be, we have to be the hottest and the densest from the point of view of baryons. This is just from experiment. The rest is, okay. Yeah. Oh, yes. Ah. Oh, very good. That's also possible. That's right. We are sort of exploring it. It's like project number 4 or 5. It's you see, the main thing is the following. You can ask the following question. How heavy can you make a fermion that cancels the baryon anomaly and still have a consistent low-energy theory? Okay? And do you have an extra transparency? The answer is the following. Okay, I'll just have to say it in words. I don't have... Okay, great. So, let's say... So, you have some U1... Let's say you have some anomalous U1 vector boson. Okay, some fermion content, etc. So let's say typical mass K, mass M. So what is the cutoff beyond which the theory needs the extra some mechanism to cancel the anomaly? This is a question, for example, Preskill wrote a very nice paper in the early 90s addressing that question. And so the answer is, well, I'll just write it symbolically. 32 pi squared, whatever. Okay, so this is the U1 anomaly. Okay, so this is the U1 anomaly. E is the charge of the U1. And the other stuff is just whatever non-abelian anomaly it may, this U1 may have. Now, E in our case is 10 to the minus 16, okay? M is, of course, 10 to the minus 16 times a TV, which is an inverse millimeter. So you have TV over something. So you can have the fermions that come to rescue the theory up at a TV or even more and still live with this. I don't understand. There is going to be, take, look at whatever dissipation we have on our side, which we can observe experimentally, okay? Let's say that the other side is a million times more dilute, okay? This means that you can compute, okay. Okay, let me fall back. The dissipation is governed by a quantity called the cooling time. The cooling time is the time that it takes for a cloud of, the cloud that has been gravitationally arrested from expanding with the rest of the universe. Yeah, but let me answer it first. Yeah. Can I answer it? Yeah, yeah. The point is the time, the cooling time scales like the inverse of the number density, okay? And if you make the number density a million times less, the cooling time will be enhanced by a million times. So.